Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studio of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, December 14th, 2017. I want to ask you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's start with announcements. From California, the Matol Action Training Camp update from the Earth First Newswire. Let the call echo through the mountains and forests of so-called Northern California. The Matol Action Training Camp is on. Activists and forest lovers across the continent are invited to converge on the Matol River watershed in Humboldt County from January 12th to 15th to learn technical climbing skills, tactics for blocking roads, and constructing tree sits and pods. Join us for these skill shares and others, as well as a chance to build affinity and friendship and learn more about the ongoing campaign to save the ancient Matol Forest. Forest folks should bring warm and waterproof gear and be ready to camp outside, though we will be trying to secure some indoor space for sleeping. Food will be provided by local organizers. If you are interested in post-camp shenanigans, please come prepared with extra warm gear, backpacks, tarps, etc. You can connect with us through Matol Action Camp at riseup.net. That's Matol Action Camp at riseup.net. And for more info, check out Save the Matol's Ancient Forest on Facebook and blockade.babes on Instagram. For the wild, the California Recreational Abalone Fishery will be closed next year. The California Fish and Game Commission yesterday voted to close the 2018 Northern California Recreational Abalone Fishery due to ongoing environmental conditions that have significantly impacted the abalone resource. The closure affects next year's recreational abalone season, which was scheduled to be open on April 1st. The Commission's 4-0 decision upholds the policies of the Abalone Recovery and Management Plan, which was adopted by the Commission in December of 25. Over the past several years, the Commission has taken several actions to reduce and shorten the take season to protect abalone from the unprecedented environmental conditions. The Commission directed the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to work with stakeholders to deliver a new fishery management plan that includes guidance on navigating these unprecedented conditions. The Commission also directed CDFW to consider how the new fishery management plan can inform the potential reopening of some fishing opportunities for abalone in the 2019 season. For more information about California's recreational abalone fisheries can be found on the California Department of Fish and Wildlife site, wildlife.ca.gov. And the reward for information on a slain Washington wolf has grown to $20,000 in this story from Oregon Environmental News. The reward for information regarding the killing of two wolves in northeastern Washington state grew to $20,000. Two conservation groups said. The Center for Biological Diversity in Cascadia Wildlands doubled the previously announced $10,000 reward by Conservation Northwest for information leading to the conviction in the killings of the wolves. Over the weekend, officials for the State Department of Fish and Wildlife announced that two wolves were being monitored had been shot to death. The animals were members of the Smackout and Dirty Shirt Packs. Poaching wolves or other wildlife is a deplorable crime, said Noah Greenwalt of the Center for Biological Diversity. We need people to come forward and put a stop to the killing of these endangered animals. Wolves are a protected species across the state of Washington. Poachers can face fines and jail times. These killings follow the poaching of three wolves in Oregon in the past several months. Poaching represents a real threat to the recovery of wolves in Washington and elsewhere on the North and West Coast, said Nick Cady of Cascadian Wildlands. Gray wolves were hunted to extinction in Washington in the early 1900s, but the animals started migrating to the state in the early 2000s from Idaho and Canada. The first wolf pack was documented by the department in 2008. At the end of 2016, the state estimated there were a minimum of 115 wolves, 20 packs, and 10 successful breeding pairs in the state. All of the documented wolf packs are east of the Cascade Range, mostly in the northeastern corner of the state. There have been numerous conflicts between wolves and livestock in recent years, and the state has killed 18 problem wolves since 2012, drawing sharp criticism from environmental groups. Wolves are listed as endangered by the state in the eastern third of Washington and have federally endangered species protection in the western two-thirds of the state. And a judge has halted the raising of Miami's forest eyed for a Walmart center. Environmentalists say the land's development would harm 20 endangered plants and animals in this story by Nina Golgowski of the Huffington Post. A judge has halted the construction of a vanishing South Florida forest that environmentalists say is home to more than a dozen endangered and threatened species, blocking for now plans to bulldoze it for a development that includes a Walmart. An emergency injunction was issued last Friday against the proposed Coral Reef Commons Shopping Center, an apartment complex located outside of the Everglades National Park and Zoo Miami, the Associated Press reported. The order of Judge Ursula Ungaro came just hours after the Center for Biological Diversity and three other groups sued its development, arguing that it would cause devastating and unlawful consequences to endangered and threatened species and their habitat. Ungaro, according to the AP, reasoned that the environmental advocates have a strong likelihood of winning their case, and so further damage to the area's shrinking pine rockland forest would be irreparable. "We are elated," Jacqueline Lopez, Florida director of the Center for Biological Diversity, told the Miami Herald in response to the injunction. The judge's order has given these plants and animals and residents of this community an opportunity for their day in court, an opportunity to have justice upheld and a fighting chance at survival, she said. Developer Pete Cummings, in a statement sent to the Herald, said he plans to fight the judge's decision. The development, which was approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would harm 20 endangered plants and animals, according to the Center for Biological Diversity, which filed the suit along with the Tropical Audubon Society, the Miami Pine Rockland Coalition, and the South Florida Wildlands Association. Species that could be harmed include the threatened eastern indigo snake, threatened gopher tortoise, the endangered Florida bricklebush, and two butterflies, the endangered Bertram's scrub hairstreak and endangered Florida leafwing. This mega development would wipe out some of Florida's last ecological gems and diminish the quality of life for nearby residents by worsening traffic and sprawl, Lopez said in a press release. Losing the Florida bonneted bat, the rare Florida leafwing butterfly, or the incredibly striking Miami tiger beetle is a tragedy that can't be undone. According to the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Miami tiger beetle was considered to be extinct when 2007 a small population was found near Zoo Miami. Since its rediscovery, the beetle is only known to survive in two separate but small populations in Miami's pine rocklands. The pine rocklands are unique to southern Florida and the Bahamas. A loss of habitat and pesticides is also blamed for endangering the Florida bonneted bat, according to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. And international direct action against a French stag hunt has found in the Earth First Newswire and published by Hunt Sabs of the United Kingdom. Hunt Saboteurs Association news release 10 December 2017. Hunt saboteurs from Croydon and Kingston joined the first major international action of its kind that saw nearly 60 hunt saboteurs from six different countries descend on the notorious Futé des Amis stag hunt in the Forest de Compagne, Bicardy, northern France. In recent weeks, the hunt killed a stag in a garden despite the homeowner begging them not to, and saw one of its own beaters killed by being pierced through the heart by a deer's antlers after he had cornered the animal. Teams of hunt saboteurs managed to maintain close contact with the hunt all day, and on three occasions managed to take control of the pack at critical moments when they were hunting a stag and two hinds, one with her young. The hunts were in complete disarray, with the huntsman Drac complaining bitterly to the French hunt saboteurs that they had not been able to kill, and that stag hunting wasn't barbaric. Traditionally, stag hunting involves hunting an animal with hounds to the point of utter exhaustion, and then the huntsman stabs the animal in the heart. However, allowing the hounds to tear the animal apart, as in fox hunting and drowning, are also approved methods for a stag hunt to make a kill. Lee Moon, press spokesperson for the Hunt Saboteurs Association, stated the Hunt Saboteurs Association has over 50 years' experience in sabotaging hunts in the United Kingdom. When we hear of similar actions happening abroad, we are more than happy to lend a hand. Congratulations to the French saboteurs for arranging this successful action, and we look forward to working with them again in the near future. and Hudson Valley Earth First has maintained tree sits to stop the Valley Lateral Pipeline. Here's their update from day two, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Members of the Hudson Valley Earth First have established a tree sit blockade in the path of the Valley Lateral Pipeline to stop its construction and save the forest. On December 8th, Millennium Pipe Company started clearing trees for the Valley Lateral Pipeline, which would connect fracked natural gas from the existing Millennium Pipeline to the scandal-ridden Toxic Power Ventures power plant. Courts and the government will never protect the land, but these brave beings have put their lives on the line to save endangered species and sacred wilderness. Day two, we have a direct update from one of our tree sitters. Cut trees leading towards wetlands and an eagle's nest into wetlands and farm fields and forests where I hear cutting. Pretty quiet where I am. Swaying in the breeze a bit this morning, tried to keep snow from getting in warm bags, and that's working well. This fight is only beginning, and this is the first known actual tree sit in the Hudson Valley ever. And there's a picture here of a tree sitter looking down at snow. This fight is only beginning. We need more affinity groups willing to take action against these projects and their world. CPV, Millennium, Legoland will destroy this bioregion. Many sink Lenape indigenous land. For more updates and photos, Hudson Valley Earth First Facebook page at facebook.com/HVEarthFirst. And court has upheld a uranium mining ban around Grand Canyon, but allows a nearby mine in this story by Juliet Eilperin of the Washington Post. The U.S. District Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit on Tuesday upheld a 20-year ban on uranium mining around Grand Canyon National Park, but ruled in a separate case that a uranium mine could open nearby. Two unanimous rulings by the three-judge panel came as the Trump administration considers lifting the ban in place since 2012 as part of a broader effort to boost domestic energy production and promote the mining of critical minerals in the United States. A House Natural Resources subcommittee held a hearing on Tuesday in which Republicans warned against putting federal lands off limits to mining. The 2012 ban blocked new mining claims and placed restrictions on mine development on existing claims in a million-acre area around Grand Canyon Park, though the Interior Department indicated that up to 11 claims could proceed. The appellate court ruled that imposing a freeze on new claims for a limited period will permit a more careful, longer-term study of the uncertain effects of uranium mining in the area and better informed decision-making in the future. The National Mining Association and other groups had challenged the ban, while the Havasupai Tribe, the Grand Canyon Trust, Sierra Club, Center for Biological Diversity, National Parks and Conservation Association all joined the Interior in seeking to continue it. U.S. District Court in Arizona ruled in favor of the federal government and its allies in 2014, and lawyers for the Justice Department argued the case before the Ninth Circuit just weeks before President Barack Obama left office. Havasupai Tribal Council member Carlotta Tulosi is one of the nearly 780 tribal members living about 15 miles from the national park on the canyon's south rim. She testified Tuesday before the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Energy and Mineral Resources, which titled its hearing Examining Consequences of America's Growing Dependence on Foreign Minerals. Tulosi said she worries about air and water contamination given uranium's toxicity and the ensuing health risks that could stem from mining, but Representative Paul Gosar, a Republican from Arizona who chairs the subcommittee, accused her of engaging in scare tactics, saying that when it comes to the risks associated with mining, you're not entitled to your own facts. In the separate case, the Ninth Circuit ruled that Energy Fuels Resources USA can open its canyon mine in Kaibab National Forest, 6 miles south of the Grand Canyon. While the site received a federal permit to open in 1986, its development stopped in the 1990s. Judges said Energy Fuels Resources can start operations without having to engage in tribal consultations or undergo a new federal environmental review. This is not a partisan issue, company spokesperson Curtis Moore said in an email. We demonstrate through our actions each and every day that we operate responsibly in providing the fuel for clean, carbon-free electricity. This was a second victory for the company in as many weeks. Last week's decision by President Trump to scale back the Bears Ears National Monument will facilitate access to uranium claims in that area. The executive had pushed the administration to downsize the Utah site. Although it is unclear whether either appellate decision will be taken to the Supreme Court, the debate will continue over how much federal land should be open for mining. The Trump administration could still lift the ban years before it is set to expire. And here's the update from the field, from the Buffalo Field campaign, entitled Incident on Horse Butte. Wispy flurries are falling as I write, but we still haven't had any real snow to speak of, though thankfully it's at least cold enough that the lake has started to freeze. We've all been delighted by the whale-like sounds coming from the lake as fluid water transforms into solid ice. It's a strange start to winter. Scary evidence that we are in the throes of climate chaos mid-December and we are still hiking around instead of skiing, and we hardly had a single day or night with negative temperatures. The good news is that, for the buffalo, travel is still really easy and grass not hard to find. We haven't even opened up our gardener camp yet because the buffalo don't yet need to migrate to lower elevation habitat. For a few weeks here on the west side in the Hebgen Basin, the buffalo had been pretty content in safe zones on Horse Butte, hanging around Yellowstone Village and the Galanis property, but things suddenly changed for the worse at the onset of last weekend. Late last week, a crazy thing happened. The buffalo moved just off of the Galanis property, the largest buffalo safe zone in Montana, onto the public portion of Horse Butte in the Gallatin National Forest, where they could be killed by hunters. With so little snow, though, snowmobiling isn't really feasible, and most hunters won't work hard for their kills. We thought the buffalo would be safe because generally hunters are lazy, and there was no way anyone was going to walk all the way around Horse Butte to shoot field dress and drag out a buffalo. We were both right and wrong. Our patrol spotted a state hunting party who appeared to be accessing the buffalo through the Galanis' property. We were shocked because we knew the Galanis' would never allow this. We received phone calls from friends in the village, and we were hearing crazy chatter over the radios, and we immediately called Grandma, our dear friend in close contact with the Galanis's, to find out if they had given permission for this. We soon learned that it was the Galanis's ranch manager who had granted permission, and wanting to take the easy way out, they wanted to bring the dead bull they killed back through this safe zone. Grandma asked that our patrols watch the hunt party and get footage and photos should they bring the dead bull through the front gate where an enormous buffalo safe zone sign is posted. We were on it. We had the front gate covered and had another patrol ready to cover the only other access point should the hunt party try to sneak out while not being seen. We waited for some time watching the hunt party through a spotting scope and binoculars ready to document their actions. In the meantime, we were also waiting for Grandma to contact the Galanis family and hopefully deny the hunt party permission to bring the buffalo through their land. After a couple of hours, the hunt party left the bull gutted and just lying there. Suddenly, their truck was coming towards the front gate and we were ready. While they didn't have the dead buffalo with them, we were able to document them coming through the safe zone and able to get photos identifying the driver. After they left, we gathered another patrol who got permission to go through the Galanis's and get a closer look at the bull and the route the hunters had taken through the property. A couple more hours passed as we watched the dead bull, hoping that a grizzly bear, a wolverine, or some wolves might be able to seize the hunter's kill. Suddenly, we spotted the hunt party coming back again. This time they had a snowmobile on a flatbed trailer. They also avoided the front gate of the Galanis's, taking a different route down Pine Needle Road towards the public land access road. We weren't sure if they had been finally denied permission by the Galanis family or if they were just trying to avoid us, but pretty soon we spotted their snowmobile arriving back at the dead bull. They took the route they should have taken to begin with. After it was all said and done, we learned that the Galanis family was furious with the ranch manager who would never have let the hunt through their property. Rest assured, it will not happen again. It was also really terrific the way the community pulled together. So many people there were watching out for the buffalo, and it was really bad judgment call on the part of the ranch manager to think that he could have ever gotten away with what he tried to do. As all this was taking place, the entire group of more than 100 buffalo moved back into the safety of the Glanises. Unfortunately, they didn't stay. The following day, as our recon patrol was inside Yellowstone, basking in the glory of a beautiful day, coming across wolf, moose, buffalo, and otter tracks, and enjoying the jazz and flight of trumpeter swans flying low right over our heads, we heard a series of gunshots. A lot of them. They were coming from the west, just outside the park boundary. After hearing more than 20 shots, we hightailed it back to our car and met up with our rove patrol. They told us that 5 buffalo had been shot. The group that had been safe on the Glanises the day before had moved back onto public land and were heading east along the northwest bluffs, likely heading for the safety of the park. But not all of them made it. When patrols went in to check on them, they came across an eerie sight, 5 dead buffalo and no hunters around. The rest of the herd was still close by. Patrol paid their respects to each of the dead buffalo. The hunt party returned after leaving the buffalo to get their field dressing tools. Not long after that, a state hunter arrived on a snowmobile and took a shot at another buffalo. After being chased away by the hunter who was hazing them away from their fallen friend, the rest of the herd continued east towards Yellowstone. The last we saw of them that day, they had disappeared into the woods in a place we call Rainbow Point Meadows and were not seen again for a number of days. And take action. Submit a comment to the Fish and Wildlife Commission in Oregon and let them know that the majority of Oregonians oppose sport trapping and hunting of wolves. Oregon has a weak and outdated wolf plan. Last Friday, Oregon wildlife officials yet again kicked the can down the road on updating it. Unfortunately, without more pressure on wildlife officials and Governor Kate Brown, an extended timeline does not guarantee a better plan for Oregon's wolves. While delay allows the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife more time to clean up their sloppily written plan, it also distances any decision from the recent rash of poaching occurring across the Pacific Northwest. As it currently stands, adopting this plan would significantly reduce restrictions for killing Oregon's wolves, as well as opening the door to hunting and trapping. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is still attempting to hide the fact that the plan authorized wolf hunting and trapping, but that is exactly what is being considered. We're not the only ones who think so. Last week, a hunting organization stated the commission will be voting on a wolf management plan that includes hunting. Oregon Hunters Association even urged the plan to be more explicit about it and advocated for Oregon to follow Idaho's example when it comes to managing the recovering animal. Please submit comments to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. They should use this extended timeline to incorporate edits to the plan and more closely align with Oregon values and the best available science, not allow further erosion of protections and conservation measures. And for more information, go to the webpage www.oregonwild.org. That's oregonwild.org. And controlled burns have limited severity of the rim fire in this story from Science Daily. Control burning of forest land helped to limit the severity of one of California's largest wildfires, according to Penn State geographers. Researchers studying the Rim Fire, which in 2013 burned nearly 400 square miles of forest in the Sierra Nevada, found the blaze was less severe in areas recently treated with controlled burns. Forest managers use controlled or prescribed fires under favorable weather conditions in an effort to reduce underbrush and fuel in forests, which can build up over time and cause more intense wildfires. We found that prescribed burns really reduce the severity of the rim fire, said Alan Taylor, professor of geography and associate in the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute at Penn State. It points to the potential use of prescribed fires to reduce severe fire effects across landscapes, he said. You can fight fire with fire. You can fight several fires using these more controlled fires under conditions that are suitable. And a northern white whale could be extinct within 20 years in this story from Mother Nature Network. For a while, it seemed as if the North Atlantic right whale was on the upswing. This critically endangered whale saw its population grow between 1990 and 2010 from 270 to 483 whales. That's not a huge increase, but it was a good sign. but it was perhaps the last good sign for these whales. Since 2015, the population has steadily declined, and a new population from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is around 458 whales, 17 of which were killed in 2017. Science can be complicated, but not in this case. Charles Stormy Mayo, director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, Massachusetts, told Yale E360. It's a simple equation, the number of right whales born every year minus the number that die. Several factors are contributing to the population decline. First, there are estimated to be only 100 breeding females, and that makes it difficult for the species to replace its dwindling numbers. This is especially challenging because many females only giving birth once every 6 years instead of 3 to 5 years, as was common in the past. And Zimbabwe has seized 200 kilograms, around 500 pounds, of ivory destined for Malaysia. An illegal shipment of 200 kilograms of ivory destined for Malaysia has been seized at Zimbabwe's main airport, an official said on Wednesday. Security agents from Zimbabwe's Parks and Wildlife Management Authority intercepted the shipment on Monday, its spokesperson Tanashi Farawa said. The ivory was stashed in 4 boxes at Robert Mugabe International Airport. Controlled ivory trade is allowed in Zimbabwe, but its export is not permitted. Farawa said at current market prices of $2,100 per kilogram, the ivory was worth $420,000. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear an update tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. right here on Free Radio. Or you could tune to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. And KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill, Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California, all rebroadcast the Earth First Update. You could also go online and listen at the Grateful Dread public radio site, gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 in the morning. Or you can always go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.